This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
All right, everybody, welcome back. It is between the hours of 6 and 8 p.m., meaning you are listening to Tech Talks on this wonderful Thursday evening. So, without further ado, we have a wonderful lineup of articles prepared for you this evening as sort of our offering to you of technology, our technical offering for the week. And so what are we going to start off first with, Grant?
That's right. We have a variety of things lined up this week, and I think the first place to start is picking up from a couple of weeks ago, I guess you could say, kind of bringing the story full back and around. Samsung has announced this week they're going to be, how should I say this, Samsung is going to be allowing people to swap out their Note 7s starting on the 21st of this month, which is Wednesday. So starting next Wednesday, you're going to be able to actually go to Samsung and get replacements. So it's going to be an impact on 1 million of the 1.5 million that have been manufactured so far. A million of those have been sold, and all of those are being recalled in the effect of the battery's unlikely possibility of having very, very critical issues, even to the point of exploding.
And in fact, Samsung has been recommending to anyone using a Note 7, they are saying that you're all right to use it, but you must, you know, do not charge it over 60% battery is what they've been telling people. So if you have one and you're only charging up to 60% and you're fearful that yours may be one of the ones affected, starting on Wednesday, you can go back to any cell phone carrier, I believe, that carries the product and get it replaced.
That's right. And so going back to last week and our discussion about Apple and where they were as, I guess you could say, where they were standing, they were in a very, very nice spot. They were coming fresh out of an announcement, and they even were in such a position that they, how do I say this? They were in a great spot because Samsung had already announced that there were issues with the batteries. Samsung was on the defense. Apple had the very strong upper hand here, and yet they really haven't had the response that one would expect, given Apple's general nature. And I've actually seen having discussions this week, because I believe they made that announcement back on last Wednesday, so we really hadn't had a whole lot of time to unpack it and talk about it with different people in the community, here at the station, just in general in your day-to-day lives. But having had a whole week to unpack this now, I really don't think Apple won in the way that you would expect somebody to be able to really score on something like Samsung having this critical of an issue. So it's surprising to me.
I agree. It is kind of surprising that, you know, for such a big name as Samsung to sort of have such an issue, especially with, you know, whenever you produce a product like this, normally there's very strict quality testing. And I find it really curious to know how this slipped through all that quality testing. It just is really kind of a one-off, very strange thing, because we've never seen any, I would say, any product produced by such a large company that's ever suffered such a fatal failure on so many devices. This, I would say, this is probably the biggest cell phone recall that has happened in the last 5 years.
This is completely without precedent. We've never seen anything like this. A company selling and then immediately recalling a million phones.
Within a period, because the phones came out in early August. They've been out about a month.
Yeah.
And I was kind of disappointed that it took as long as it did for them to finally actually announce the recall.
This really isn't a horrible response time.
Considered it's a multinational company, and we're talking about 1 million phones worldwide, not just in the U.S., right?
Yeah, no, this
yeah.
is...
So I can kind of understand that, because not only is Samsung having to talk with the U.S. government, they're having to talk with the Chinese government, with the Japanese government, with English government, a lot of European governments. They're more or less having to talk to most any government that they sell their products in. That they have a presence in any country, and work with them saying, hey, this device has an issue that we need to recall it and set up a replacement program. We're producing replacements, you know. So I'm not disappointed in the response time. I'm just kind of surprised that it took as long as it did, you know.
That's fair to say. I think that's completely fair.
But yeah, it's very, very odd. That's for sure. It's like you said, without precedent, and we've never had to see anything like this before.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. Coming from another technical company, and it's not a company that we talk about a lot, Epson Fast Photo. So what Epson has done is they have launched a new printer that is going to be able to scan at about a photo a second, which... If you've ever had to digitize any amount of glossy photos, it can be kind of an arduous process. A lot of scanners can't hold more than 10 of them at a time, and it's a huge undertaking of a process. And so it is certainly refreshing to see such a focus on this fast scanning process. And I'm interested to see if this is going to roll out in a larger sense, if this also applies to just an individual page. Because certainly there's a lot of detail that needs to be taken with a photo. But if I can get a 300 dot per inch scan of a paper, even faster, I mean, you can talk about pages per second of scanning power. That's impressive.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. This is definitely going to be a great innovation for people who do a lot of archival products, a lot of archival work, because a lot of photographs are, you know, the very high gloss that we're used to, as opposed to just being printed out on regular paper. Or I should say any photo that you're, you know, really interested in digitizing will be a gloss photo, as opposed to just being a photo you printed out on paper and want to get back into digital form. You know, that... you don't see that happen. So it's really been sort of something that's been left unattended, I would say.
I think that's fair to say.
And so as a result, you know, Epson was like, wow, we've skipped this. Let's actually do this thing. And then, you know...
Neglected, perhaps? I feel like the idea of fast
scanning...
I don't
know. We've not seen a whole lot in scanner technology in the past 5-6 years.
Yeah.
You know, the last big breakthrough were those scanner wands, and even then, those weren't all that great.
And they're really not that fast, either. I mean, really what it is, it's a revolution in size, which is really just somebody taking up the gauntlet of saying, wow, the last big innovation in scanners was 5 years ago. Let's try to beat that. It won't be hard now. And I feel like this is a similar
Not
step.
To mention, Epson's really, honestly, I'd say they've got a pretty, they are a sizable force on the market of standalone scanners. Most scanners you find nowadays are going to be built into all-in-one printers. As far as getting a standalone individual scanner that is separate from a printer, Epson's really about the only route to go if you want a good quality scanner. So It's also, you know, I think that's why, in part, we haven't seen any big innovations in scanning technology, because all-in-one printer, scanner, and faxers have become so popular, because it's so convenient to have all of those services in one machine, and it takes up less desk space no matter where you're at. I'm pretty positive that's why we haven't seen any innovations in scanning technology. The next big innovation, I'd say, then, is it, you know, for Epson to sell their scanner devices and start putting them in things like HP printers or Ricoh printers or, you know, Lexmark printers and cut a deal with a big printer company and put Epson scanners inside of other people's printers.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's completely fair to try to advertise.
If anyone from Lexmark is listening, go for it.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair to say that there's certainly something to be said for doing one thing and doing it well. And I think that's kind of the direction that Epson's moving in. I have the stats on that one photo per second is at 300 dpi, but you can opt for a slightly slower 600.
Now what is dpi?
Dots per inch. And so dpi is the way in which we talk about the precision with which things are printed out and or scanned back into digital media.
Sort of like, if you remember how comic book is, there's a lot of dots. It's a, you know, if you look closely at a comic book, it's got a lot of dots on the ink just because that's how comics have been printed, is in that dot form printing. And most printers actually, that is how most printers work, is they actually just drop, you know, an insane amount of really insanely small dots in a certain arrangement and certain color configuration in order to make colors and blend colors, much in the way that your pixels on your TV work.
And that's a pretty good comparison. Really, I guess you could say the difference between a TV and the way a printer works is that 300 dots per inch on a printer means that no matter how big your piece of paper is, it's the same amount of dots in every inch.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike your TV, where a TV that's rated as 1080p for a, you know, 40-inch TV, actually the dots are a lot smaller and a lot harder to see than you know, like a 60-inch TV or an 80-inch TV. Mm-hmm. It's the same number of dots total on the whole canvas. So really that's the difference there, is that 300 dpi and 600 dpi, we're talking about the number of individual points that it can measure or print out per inch.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's kind of an issue with this printing, rescanning thing, in that you always lose a little bit of the image every time you do that process. Mm-hmm. Because we've long been able to manufacture things and print things out with much better precision with which we're able to read them back.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is a step in the right direction towards these mass archival projects. Because, I mean, let's think about it. Data storage has gotten so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
The Smithsonian has been actively working on digitizing even decades ago when it was expensive. They're still working on it now, except now it's insanely cheap. And this is the kind of thing that I think is going to make it insanely fast.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I think this is the kind of tool that's really going to launch them. Things like the Library of Congress, where they struggle to stay in the double digits of their whole archive being digitized, you know? It's that kind of a thing that I think is really going to help move them forward. All right, well, the current time is 6:32, so we're going to take a break and come back here in a little bit. Thanks for joining us here on Tech Talks. My name is Grant.
I am Mitch.
And we will be back here in just a few minutes. Got a couple more songs lined up for you, so be sure to keep it locked all the way to the left. Here with me, and here with us, at WRFL Lexington. We'll see you in just a few minutes. Thanks for tuning in here with us. We are here, live in the studio, for yet another episode of Tech Talks here on WRFL. Lexington's very own weekly technology talk show.
That is right, everybody. We are also Lexington's best talk show, but that is not by competition. That is by default. Let that be known.
You're not wrong, honestly. You have a fair point. I guess the only of something by requirement must be the best. I'm not saying that to be like, oh, wow, look at us, we're the greatest, but you know,
it's just a logical property of things.
We are the only alternative left, if that's what you're looking for.
True. We are the only alternative left. And we are the best talk show of technology on the only alternative left.
That's fair.
Again, by default.
That's fair.
So, what have we got up next?
Up next. And I think you'll enjoy this one.
I better. If I don't enjoy it, I'm going to be rather upset.
Microsoft is further bolstering their claims that Edge is the best browser.
I like this. You will not be punished. Congratulations.
How are they claiming to do so? They are sharing data about how they believe that Edge has the lowest browser consumption, or like energy consumption and resource consumption among the popular browsers.
Probably because it doesn't do a whole lot of anything at all.
That's fair.
I mean, you look at all the stuff that's integrated into Google Chrome. You know, some of it bad, some of it very, you know, I'll admit, Google Chrome is very taxing on your system.
It honestly is.
I haven't messed much with Edge, but the thing is, Edge just does not look user-friendly. For whatever reason, it's literally the look of the Microsoft browser that has really pushed me towards, like, Google Chrome. And it's the same with Firefox as far as on a personal level. You know, I don't care for the look of Firefox, and I don't care for the look of Edge, but I really enjoy the design of Google Chrome.
That's fair. That's fair. There's different motivations to why someone would like one browser and not another. I originally moved away from Firefox and to Chrome because Firefox became too heavy of an experience. I don't know. There was something very weighty about the way that Firefox was. It was, you know, it had powerful caching and things like that, but it was also really painfully slow to open. And I'm starting to find the same thing to be true about Chrome. To be honest, there are times at which Chrome just idling with several tabs open, and that's part of the problem that I have, is that I keep tabs open and don't get tasks done, which means that tasks pile up, which means that tabs pile up. But there are times at which I have more memory allocated to Chrome than to my entire operating system, sometimes by a factor of two or three,
which is kind of crazy. So, you know, in all honesty, I think it's time for me and you to start a review. I think we need to do a Microsoft Edge review and report our results next week.
All right.
And so what I'm going to say this entails is that for the next week, the only thing that you and I can use is Microsoft Edge.
I'm going to put the caveat on that I'm going to continue to use Chrome
on Ubuntu.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you have a different operating system.
Yeah.
But
that said, when I'm using Windows, I will use
And you need Edge. To make sure to use Windows more often than you do the other one. Because otherwise, it's not as fair. And it's going to be a one-sided review. And we can't do that to the good people of Lexington.
Well, I'll see what I can do. I'll see what I can do this week. No All promises, right. but All I right. will participate then. When I'm using Windows, I will use Edge, which I guess means I'm going to have to move over the like 20 tabs I have open in Chrome right now. So, high five me.
Just copy them over as you need them.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, we will report back next week as to what we find on our Chrome usage.
Yeah.
And who knows? Maybe we can make this a weekly segment where we pick something that is easy to access for everyone to use that is useful. Who knows? We might make this a thing.
Yeah, I hope we do. But Microsoft has really been kicking it into high gear in the past month on their Edge Eats Less Battery campaign. That's the core of what this is spiraling around. The idea that Edge chewing up less of your memory and less of your CPU resources
and less of your RAM
means that it's going to be using a lot less of your of just power in general. And so that's also something that I'm going to take some amount of effort to measure. I'll see how successfully I can do that. And we'll report back on the findings on that. I'm curious to see.
They've issued the challenge, and we shall accept.
They've thrown down the gauntlet.
To finally prove that the Microsoft browser is in some way better than Chrome. And as the defenders of Chrome, we will find out if it's true or not.
At this point, I'm just going to say that I'm not trying to defend one over the other. I'm curious now, because these are bold claims.
They are, but I'm saying defenders of Chrome is that we've always been Google fellows.
That's
you know, we've
That's
always you know used Google for almost everything. We just, you know, that's just who we are.
That's fair.
So, again, we'll report back. What have we got up next?
All right, coming up next, We have an article coming to us, and it's about solar energy and where we're looking to go from there. Mm-hmm. And this has been kind of a tricky thing. The entire solar market has really been struggling over the past calendar year. I mean, really, by and large, been struggling. So, I don't know.
We're going to break down what it means after the break. We're going to take a 15-minute break.
Okay,
we're going to break down what it means. And also, we're going to investigate. We had a caller call in and suggest two stories for us to cover. One of them being whether or not the Elon Musk was actually impersonated via an email account, which was ironically an article I saw myself earlier today, but I've not fact-checked it. So we're gonna double-check on that. And he also brought up the fact that he saw an article saying Nintendo released their their next-gen console, I should say. So we're going to look into that and see if those are true, and we'll be back and let you know whether or not they are true. And if they are true, we'll do a brief intro about them, maybe.
Yeah.
We'll just see where it's at. And just as always, we love it when you guys call in and interact with us and, ask us questions, and we do our best to try to answer those.
All right. The current time is 7 o'clock, and you are tuned in here to WRFL Lexington.
That would be your only alternative left. And more specifically, you are tuned into Lexington's very own Tech Talk Show program, Tech Talks, every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. So keep it locked all the way to the left with us here.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to wrfl.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.
Current time is 7:10 and you were tuned in here to WRFL Lexington. We here at Tech Talks have done some gathering over the break. We've had a couple callers now call in and ask about different topics, and we actually have some follow-up information on that. So going to go ahead and deliver that information right quick here to you, because they're both pretty short follow-ups. It's been a wild day for Tesla and for Elon Musk. It's actually been confirmed, this coming from NBC, that Tesla will be suing an oil executive, the executive who is behind the group, and I just lost the name of the oil company they're going after, but they're going to be going after them for impersonation charges. The lawsuit, which was filed yesterday, says that Quest Integrity Group's CFO sent emails to Tesla from a Yahoo email address that was intentionally set up to appear to be Elon Musk, and that it was meant to be an impersonation. It was meant to be kind of a phishing thing, I guess you could say. And so Tesla has announced that they will actually be pursuing against that executive. So we'll have more information as this rolls out, and this probably won't be a story that we'll be able to really unpack anymore until next week, but it is interesting to see. They kind of shot an email out into the dark to some Tesla executives, I guess trying to comb out some sensitive information out of them, I guess you could say, as a way of trying to extract some information from them. And we'll have the link to this article over on our Facebook page. You can keep up with us there. That's facebook.com/WRFL Tech Talks. The other thing that we wanted to come back around to is that Miyamoto, the head of Nintendo, has said that they are not currently interested in any form of virtual reality on their next generation of consoles at all, whatsoever, in any capacity. Which is interesting to see them take a stand against this craze that has been everything in... Everything has kind of moved towards this virtual or semi-virtual format, or at least allowed for it to have a virtual reality component, and Nintendo has said that they are not changing course on that. So, those are two follow-ups from two callers who called in during the break, so thanks for calling in. It was good to talk to you, and we always want to hear what you're thinking. So if you have any thoughts, shoot it on over to us. You can hit us up with an email at wrfltechtalks@gmail.com, or you can call in. The number here at the station is 257-WRFL. It's 257-9735. We'll be back with you here in just a few minutes. Be sure to keep it locked all the way to the left, all the way up till 8 o'clock and beyond. We'll catch up with you here in just a few minutes. Let's see. In the last segment, we talked about an upcoming story we're going to come back to about solar energy. So in 2016, it's been estimated that the solar energy industry as a whole has grown 43%. And they're expecting to see up to 80% more growth through the rest of this year. So we're talking about what should, by all measures, be a very successful year to be a solar energy company, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And one of the odd things about it is that the numbers, and especially some of the stock performance to these rather famous solar companies, really is just not keeping up for the course, which is strange. It's strange to think that you're having this year where the whole industry is showing lots of growth, and yet they're really not performing in the way that you would expect. And one of the companies you can point to is SolarCity, who's had a big up and down swing this year. Over the past year, has gone up by almost 50%, and then at this point has fallen by 40%. You know, so they've been up and down 100% the whole value of their market this year. That's kind of incredible, really.
It really is kind of fascinating, to be 100% honest. You don't see, there aren't very many sectors of the economy that have fluctuated in that manner. And I find it very strange that of all things to fluctuate in that manner, that it's solar energy. And I'm just kind of curious what's causing that fluctuation, because if you think about it, solar energy is typically a very stable thing. You know, if you're a solar company, you know, it's no matter what, you're expected to get so much sunlight statistically wherever you put your solar panels, unless you're putting them in Alaska during their 8-month night or however long that is. I can't remember the exact number.
And that's true and that's fair. But where solar energy is very consistent, the programs and the subsidies and the benefits that a lot of people have been taking advantage of, both residentially and
commercially,
come and go. And so they have this very feast and famine behavior with the way that solar panels go. And so you see, and this has been a consistent trend, that in the last quarter of every year is always the best performing quarter. The fourth quarter of 2015 outperformed every other quarter in U.S. history, as did the fourth quarter of 2014, as did 2013, as
did 2012. I almost wonder if that isn't so much to do with actual market fluctuation as it is weather patterns. Because, you know, here we have an industry in the stock market, that, you know, in a publicly traded market, that is actually 100% dependent on weather that is not food-related. Or you know, and I'm just really curious, because if you think about it, the fourth quarter, you know, the fiscal year ends in July.
Yeah.
Yeah. So July 1st is when the fiscal year rolls over, correct?
That's correct.
Or is it August 1st? I can never remember.
A lot of fiscal years end
July 1st.
Or July 1st, yeah.
Okay. So if you think about the time frame of when that fourth quarter is, it's the time frame when everything's more or less coming out of hibernation for the winter, and it's getting there's a lot of sunlight increased across the board. You know, just because
we're
of the time
about
of the year.
Fourth quarter on a calendar year.
On a calendar year is typically the months coming out of spring and going into summer.
No. On a Julian calendar.
Yes.
December, fourth quarter.
Oh, I thought we were talking about a fourth fiscal quarter.
No, we're talking about a calendar year.
I apologize.
Yeah.
Then ignore everything I was going in that tangent I was going from. I thought I had come up with a really reasonable explanation if we were talking about the fourth quarter of a fiscal year, not a calendar year.
Yeah, no, that I can definitely see where you're going, and that makes sense, but that's what's so unintuitive about this is that it's the dead opposite of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's October through December.
Which also doesn't make a lot of sense because that's when the shortest days are. There's the least amount of sunlight during that period, which is really kind of confusing as to why it would be more record performing during that time frame than any other. Because, I mean, I understand that, you know, you can still experience solar energy when it's overcast. I mean, you can get a sunburn when it's cloudy out if you're not careful. And, you know, not a lot of people think about it, but I guess, you know, I personally am not that familiar with what happens whenever light hits a solar panel as far as what it's... I know it's some sort of photolytic reaction that the actual light hitting the material that the panel is made out of generates an electric charge or splits electrons off. And I get that, but I'm not exactly sure how it happens or what the materials are. And I'm really kind of curious if even the overcast ambient light that happens on a cloudy day or sort of like what you would imagine your typical, you know, day in London where it's all cloudy and whatnot, if you can still get a good return on solar panels during that time. That's something I've never actually thought about.
I wouldn't exactly call it good performance, but there's definitely still the performance there, you can say.
Yeah.
And I guess you could call it acceptable performance. Mm-hmm.
Well, then I will change tack and ask you another question then. Do we know where most of these are we talking international solar companies? Are we talking local U.S.-based solar companies? Because if they're international, I can understand how if there's a solar company down in Brazil and they just have a massive solar farm down in Brazil, that makes sense because whenever we're experiencing the shortest day of the year in the southern hemisphere directly beneath us in South America, they're experiencing the longest day of the year. And I believe, isn't it the middle of their summer there?
Yeah. Yeah. No, the seasons have inflections. They're opposites. Mm-hmm.
Couldn't remember if it was like still winter there, but sunny.
No, it's the dead of winter here is the
middle of summer.
Heat
there.
Of summer there. And that's true across the deep edge of the entire
world.
South part of the world. That's Australia and the southern part of Africa and even up into the northern, the part that's to the north of the Saharan Desert,
mm-hmm.
and then throughout
the Mediterranean portion of Africa.
And then throughout South America. Yeah, so...
And obviously also the Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
You know, India and that whole region.
And certainly nobody is holding back on companies like Solar City or SunPower from getting out into the global market. And so it certainly does make sense that they're...
Well, I'm just curious. I'm just trying to come up with a reason why they're performing well in the dead of winter if we're assuming they're only based in the U.S.
And we're talking
or
about
primarily
we're
based.
Talking about these in, the statistics for these installations though are coming strictly from U.S. numbers.
Okay, then that's what I'm finding most baffling, and that's what I'm trying to rationalize is why they're that high, and I'm really curious.
Yeah, the market performance seems to be pointing to a little bit of the kind of last second, how do you say this? The last second bargain.
Push.
It's like the last second clearance effect, in that there are a number of programs and green energy
initiatives,
tax write-offs, initiatives, state by state, all the way up to the federal level, that all terminate
on that date
on January 1st of every year. And so I think there's a lot of panic to cycle back around really quick and buy the solar panels. Because think about it, if you're putting together a project that's going to take 9, 12, I don't know, maybe in the case of something like a student center on a large university, 24, 30 months,
mm-hmm.
And so it'd be in your best interest to make sure that you buy those panels and get them installed and really push to get them in that last quarter of the year while you know that you're still going to be able to land.
Okay,
your,
so you're saying impulse buys before the peak performance time of solar panels.
I think it's an impulse thing.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense than anything I was thinking. I was thinking of it not so much in terms of the buyer as the actual company itself doing something to change its performance in the fourth quarter. What you just described to me is actually people who would be purchasing solar panels would buy them in December, and it would go on that last part of that calendar quarter. And then they would be installed throughout the spring and then start reaping the benefit immediately in the summer. You know, and that really, I guess, would explain the trend if that's the case of what's happening. So, you know, now that I can logically think of some case in which it's happening, it makes a lot more sense, you know.
It still feels unintuitive, though.
Oh, yeah.
It's this wild up and down behavior, almost doubling their sales in the last quarter, that really leads to this uncomfortable feast and famine behavior that is really, honestly, I can see why investors would be afraid of that. That's
erratic behavior. And anytime you're investing in something, erratic behavior in a market is very scary.
Yeah, any kind of behavior like that is going to be intimidating. And so I can see why it has that impact. And so is it going to be the case that we're just going to see it rise back up again leading into December, and then after December gradually? Is this just going to be a yearly
roller coaster
that these...
I mean, it makes sense based on what you said. Based on
fair.
The government programs and the way that a lot of people handle their financials, and, you know, a lot of businesses, corporations, you know, the corporate side of, you know, things,
yeah,
the residential side of things, it's less... Honestly, solar energy at this point is less of a residential market, if you think of it that way.
Absolutely.
Your average resident's not going to go out and buy a bunch of solar panels and put on their roof. And if they do, they're not going to do it because, oh, it's December, it's about time for the end of this fiscal quarter, I should probably get this ready.
Yeah. I think we're going to continue to see this
The corporate and commercial behavior that we just described is by far more likely the cause. Mm-hmm. of that trend. And I don't know, if you're an investor and you see that and you're able to reason out to where we are right now, you know, it doesn't seem, you know, very scary of an investment, you know, especially given the statistics you said, how consistently each year has been outperforming the last come the end of that fourth quarter.
Yeah.
You know?
And so what it kind of does is, I guess you could say, it jumps up a tier every year. Mm-hmm. at the end of the year, it kind of has this nice gradual little jump it makes, and then it, you know, maybe drops a little bit, but then the next year the whole platform jumps up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so these spikes, though, used to, they were fairly inconsequential. They were a small...
Well, it was a smaller business then. It's becoming, especially with the closure of coal, it's, you know, solar power is becoming a very lucrative initiative for a lot of local governments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would not surprise me. You know, for example, the University of Kentucky, our engineering building, you know, Ralph G. Anderson building, recently within the past 2 or 3 years since we've been here, have added solar panels to the roof of the building.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great initiative.
Oh, yeah, and it would be really refreshing to see a lot of places, you know, cities like Lexington subsidize some solar panel farms, you know? So, yeah. You know, especially given the fact that we're pushing away from non-renewable energy sources and are trying to go to renewable energy sources.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to add one last point onto this before we run out of time, someone actually told me, you know, I was discussing this with a couple, you know, people I have, you know, am friends with on the Student Sustainability Council here at the university. And they brought up the fact, well, you know, why don't, after we're done strip mining the top of a hill or for whatever reason, why not invest in solar panels and wind turbines to put on top of that hill instead of it just looking like, oh, here are these weird patches on these random hills that look like golf courses that are just, you know, deforested areas. You could very easily put solar panels and wind turbines up on the top of those hills in eastern Kentucky, where there have been a lot of mountaintop removal, and in West Virginia, and all of Appalachia, really, where mountaintop removal has happened. And yet there's not been any kind of initiatives set forth on that yet, and I find that very strange.
That's fair. I think that's a really good point, that there's not been any initiative to reclaim that space and renaturalize space after, because once a strip mine is complete, and there's not really a whole lot of...
It just turns into grass. And that's the other good thing that would follow this trend of the winter thing, is that all the vegetation would be dead for the winter. It'd be a lot easier to clear out and go in there and clear the space out, get ready for it. You might not be able to dig because it's harder to dig in the winter. But you can clear it all out in time for the spring. And then spring comes around, you just dig on down into the mud and start putting these things up.
All right.
So with that, it looks like we're out of time for this episode of Tech Talks. We thank you for tuning in and teching out with us here this week as we have been going through everything. And, we thank you, callers, and people who've reached out to us during and before the show. At any time throughout the week, if you see an interesting article and think, wow, that'd be pretty cool if Tech Talks would talk about this, feel free to message us on our Facebook page, and we'll definitely look into it. And, we'd love to have you, the audience, have more of an input on our content here because, again, as we've always said, this show is for you all,
Yeah. And as always, we're going to be peppering articles throughout the week onto our Facebook page, and it's including content that we don't have time to discuss here. And so you can continue that conversation there. Please join us on Facebook, and you can participate in the discussion that we have centered around the articles and content that we find. And hopefully you can help us find some new content to bring back around to you for next week. So thanks for joining us. That's all the time we have for this week. And we'll be back next week, same time as always, 6 to 8 every Thursday, here on WRFL Lexington. This has been Tech Talks. We'll see you next week.